stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump seems optimistic about the newly arranged talks between North and South Korea set to occur during the Winter Olympics.
I hope they do. I would love to see them take it beyond the Olympics. We have a very good relationship with South Korea. I would love to see it go far beyond the Olympics. Absolutely. And at the appropriate time, we'll get involved.
The president also said that he had spoken with South Korean leader Moon Jae-in, who thanked him very much for his tough stance. Iranian leadership is responding to anti-government protests that began more than a week ago. The country's parliament is set to hold a special session. VOA's Margaret Bashir tells us this follows backlash during a UN Security Council meeting.
U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley surprised council members this week by calling for the public session. Haley said the week-old protests that have rapidly spread to nearly 80 cities and towns across Iran are evidence of the people's long-festering frustration.
The Iranian people understand the nature of their regime. They understand that their lack of voice in their government has allowed the regime to ignore them. And it has allowed the regime to spread conflict and instability far and wide.
Demonstrators are angry about the economic situation and the government's use of resources in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen instead of at home. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Syrian regime forces seized a key town in the Islamic State stronghold region of Idlib. According to the British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, government forces backed by Russian air power captured Sinjar, the biggest town in the southeast area of the province. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump is responding to a new book written by author Michael Wolff about the president's first year in office.
This guy that doesn't know me at all. By the way, did not interview me for three. He said he interviewed me for 3 hours in the White House. It didn't exist, okay? It's in his imagination.
Wolff's book, Fire and Fury, portrays the first year of the Trump presidency as one in shambles, and the president is childlike and possibly in need of psychiatric help. Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Theresa May was asked her thoughts on the leader of Britain's strongest ally.
You've seen a lot of Donald Trump one way or another. Child or stable genius?
I do. Obviously, I've worked with President Trump on a number of issues, as we continue to work with the United States on a number of issues. President Trump,
I think... What do you make of him?
What I make of him is somebody who is taking decisions on what he believes is in the best interests of the United States.
May was a guest on the BBC's Andrew Marr show. 32 crew members of a Chinese oil tanker remain missing after it collided with a bulk freighter. Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda reports.
The vessel called the Sanxi is a Panamanian ship carrying oil from Iran to South Korea, just under a million barrels, worth about $60 million. It's not immediately clear how big the spill is or the cause of the accident. The missing crew all came from the tanker. The Chinese vessel's crew is all accounted for and safe.
U.S. health experts say that the influenza season is proving to be more severe than usual, with about twice the number of people reporting flu-like illnesses to their doctors as compared to the same time last year. The Centers for Disease Control reports that in the week ending December 23rd, 36 states reported widespread flu activity. Nearly 2,500 people have been hospitalized for flu-related symptoms. The CDC reported that 13 children have died of the virus in the current flu season, which started in October. The CDC says across the nation about 5% of patients saw their doctors for flu-like symptoms in the week ending December 23rd, compared to 2.2% of patients last year. U.S. President Donald Trump once again says that unless a program that protects hundreds of thousands of immigrants from deportation contains new policies that he's outlined, he will not support it. He was referring to the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which expires in March. In September, Mr. Trump rescinded what's commonly known as DACA, which was instituted by former President Barack Obama. Trump gave Congress until March 5th to agree on legislation that would allow equivalent protections. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Clote is on vacation.
The charges that my client is facing are really ridiculous charges. These are charges whereby they are saying that he donated to churches some television screens.
Two former Zimbabwean cabinet ministers appear in court on corruption charges.
Europe has decided to cooperate with Libyan authorities, knowing the kind of torture, abuses, detention that migrants and refugees are exposed to in Libya.
The number of migrants crossing the Mediterranean to Europe drops as the European Union says its policies to ease the crisis are working.
The Secretary General, during the appraisal of the Global Plan of Action, stressed that trafficking should be a priority across all pillars of the UN.
And the UN is to develop guidelines for airlines to train cabin crew members to identify and report on trafficked victims. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Now, let's begin in Zimbabwe, where two former cabinet ministers who were loyal to ousted President Robert Mugabe appeared in court on Saturday on corruption charges. But as Sebastian Mhofa reports from Harare for VOA, their lawyers say the charges are pure victimization, targeting those who are against President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who replaced Mugabe.
Former Foreign Affairs Minister Walter Muzembe and former Energy Minister Samuel Udenge were arrested Friday and appeared in court Saturday, where they were released on bail. Job Sikala, the lawyer for Muzembe, spoke to reporters after court proceedings.
The charges that my client is facing are really ridiculous charges. These are charges whereby they are saying that he donated to churches some television screens, those that were used during the World Cup period. They are saying that they were supposed to having been rotten at the ministry. Secondly, also in terms of the charge, they are saying that the donation should have been done in consistency of his role and duties. But at that material time, I understand that my client innovated a new concept of religious tourism, the one that he was trying to promote around our local prophets, to which the inconsistency of his duties cannot be found out of such an allegation. So we are waiting on the 22nd when we are going to make an application for exception to the charge.
The duo joins former Finance Minister Ignatius Chombo and former Mines Minister Walter Chidakwa and several other senior officials who are out on bail on corruption-related charges. Some of their lawyers told VOA last month that their court crime, unquote, was supporting former First Lady Grace Mugabe to take over from her husband, who gave in to military pressure and resigned last November. President Emmerson Mnangagwa replaced the 93-year-old. Mugabe had fired Mnangagwa as the country's vice president, accusing him of dishonesty and disloyalty. On Saturday, the Minister of Home Affairs, Obed Mpofu, said the arrest had nothing to do with politics.
No, that's an operational issue. I cannot comment on that.
That's all Mpofu, under whose ministry Zimbabwe police fall, said before hanging up his phone. Sebastian Mhofu for VOA News, Harare.
A A true treasure overlooks the city of Kinshasa on top of Ngaliema Hill. An exhibition room of a few dozen square meters is too small to contain the 45,000 pieces that have been collected from across the Democratic Republic of Congo. But this is the temporary solution to keep some of this collection open to the public until a new and bigger museum opens in 2018. For VOA, Abdurahman Dia has this report from Kinshasa.
Director Joseph Ibongo says staff are working on a full inventory of the museum's holdings.
This comes at the right time. We have to move the collections to the new museum in a year. Therefore, there are prerequisites before we can do that.
VOA was given a guided tour of the reserve room for masks, only open to the staff. Here, the creativity of the Congolese people is apparent.
The mask in Africa
hides something.
You
have to unveil it. It hides, and it's up to you to reveal it.
Museum curator Henri Bagnata says Congolese masks preserve the influences and flavors of Congolese life.
When the mask comes out, sometimes it represents an ancestor. Sometimes it's a woman, and women represent life. We learn a lot through the masks, even the gestures, the songs. All this relates to history.
The Kinshasa Museum is also home to archaeological researchers. In this room, hundreds of pieces recovered from excavation sites are reviewed by scholars. Here, pieces of pottery from ancient Congolese populations, as well as pieces showing first contacts with colonizers. VOA toured the museum's collection of musical instruments for dozens of Congolese ethnic groups. Ibongo says drums used for festivals are often called on in solemn occasions as well.
This is made of lizard skin, you see? Sometimes the soundbox is made of pottery. It needs special care and a lot of delicacy when you use it.
C'est fragile.
Once the new building opens, officials hope the Kinshasa Museum will be a center for the artistic and historical study of a country renowned for its cultural diversity from Africa's Great Lakes to the Atlantic. Abdurahman Dia, VOA News, Kinshasa.
Some Kenyan opposition lawmakers have called on the government to investigate why 90% of students who took the 2017 secondary education exams are failed. The Minister of Education maintains he is satisfied with the results. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Speaking to reporters in Nairobi, opposition legislator Caleb Amisi says Parliament needs to know why students failed.
Kenya National Examination Council, NEC, must be ordered to prepare and present a comprehensive report over this perceived mass failure, and an independent investigation should as well be incorporated. This should be conducted by some of the most credible auditing companies in Kenya.
In 2017, more than 600,000 students sought for secondary education exams. Only 10% scored high enough to enter a university. The results have sparked an uproar among parents, teachers and others concerned about the fate of the students and the quality of Kenya's education system. A key question is what caused the high failure rate. Was it the students, the people who taught them, the curriculum or a speed-up grading process that saw educators plow through the exams in just 3 weeks? Mark Nyamita, an opposition lawmaker, says the problem needs to be fixed or millions of young Kenyans will be barred from higher education.
If this goes on in this government over the next 5 years, we're going to have a whooping 2.5 million plus people with their future shattered.
Some officials say the mass failure resulted from efforts to reduce cheating, In an interview with Citizen Television, Education Minister Fred Matiang'i hinted that might be true, saying the result reflects the real state of Kenyan education.
I am very satisfied with the results we've had in the last 2 years, 2016 and 2017, because we have lived a lie for such a long time. Time is here for us now to deal with the truth.
Calls are growing for a national conference to resolve the crisis and decide what to do about the students who fail the exams. The issue is expected to be discussed in the National Assembly in February. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The number of migrants crossing the Mediterranean to Europe continued to fall last month, and the European Union says its policies to ease the crisis are working. But Amnesty International claims the bloc's collaboration with the Libyan groups involved in the detention of migrants makes it complicit in gross human rights abuses. VOA's Henry Ridgewell looks back on Europe's migrant crisis in 2017 at the political fallout from the huge influx in previous years. Fallout continues to be felt.
In 2017, Europe claimed success in slowing the arrival of migrants. On the so-called Central Mediterranean route from North Africa, arrivals were down by a third. But Amnesty International's Maria Serrano says this has come at a terrible human cost.
Europe has decided to cooperate with Libyan authorities, knowing the kind of torture, abuses, detention that migrants and refugees are exposed to in Libya.
In November, video emerged apparently showing migrants being sold at a slave market in Libya, prompting international outrage and calls for urgent action from the President of the European Council, Donald Tusk.
Let me repeat my call to impose UN sanctions on human smugglers and traffickers.
European countries are providing tens of millions of dollars and training to the Libyan Coast Guard and armed groups under the control of the Tripoli Unity government. That makes Europe complicit in the abuse, says Amnesty's Serrano.
They are sent to detention centres, official detention centres, and then militias and other armed groups and Libyan officials control these centres. So this is a source of money for them. Migrants are extorted. They are forced to call their families, and their families are listening to awful abuses they suffer. So they receive beatings, they are tortured, women are raped.
The European Union has funded emergency repatriation flights to take migrants stranded in Libya back to their home countries. But there appears to be little political willingness to soften Europe's stance. EU leaders have trumpeted the falling migrant numbers as a way of countering anti-migrant populist forces, says political analyst Leopold Traugott of Open Europe.
The repercussions of the recent influx in 2016 and 2015 are still felt in most European countries. So until the EU decides and implements a new reform of its migration policies that is able to deliver sustainable solutions, the migrant crisis will still be an issue for European countries.
In 2015, Germany took in more than a million migrants. The backlash boosted support for the far right and cost Chancellor Angela Merkel votes at the September election. But supporters say her ultimate victory is proof that Germany and Europe can successfully integrate the migrants. Nevertheless, the European Union appears determined to close down the routes across the Mediterranean. Despite the risk of torture, abuse and drowning, more than 160,000 migrants made the journey in 2017. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The International Labour Organization, ILO, says 40 million people were victims of forced labour and modern slavery in 2017. The 2016 global report from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime says that the majority of trafficking victims, 51%, are women. The UN Human Rights Office has been working with the International Civil Aviation Organization to develop guidelines for airlines to train cabin crew members to identify and report on trafficked individuals. Yola Hadadin, an advisor on trafficking in persons with OHCRR, spoke with UN Radio's Mustafa Al-Gamar on the new guidelines.
The initiative was the ICAO initiative at the first place, because they believed that human trafficking touches upon the very human rights of any individual. That's why they got in touch with me and they suggested we work together on something. So the idea came out, you know, let's do some guidelines to assist civil aviation authorities and airlines in training their staff on how to identify victims of trafficking. The guidelines are very simple, very short, because the target group are not legal experts, but rather cabin crew. So they will give them an idea about what is trafficking, why does it happen, how does it happen, what are the different forms of trafficking, and then what are the general indicators they should be looking at, and what are the cabin-specific indicators they should monitor on board the flight in order to be able to identify a victim of trafficking.
And when do you expect these guidelines to be rolled out by, and is there any airline or any country that has already implemented similar guidelines?
It will be rolled out very soon. Some airlines have already started developing their own modules. And, you know, the guidelines, they go to civil aviation authorities first, which is a regulatory body that decides over what type of training airlines should be providing for their staff. It has been already agreed that the guidelines will be part of the mandatory training. I have to say, we have only in the U.S., airlines already have started training their cabin crews and staff on victim identification. Canada is already developing a training module. And, of course, they have adapted the training module according to the guidelines we have already worked on. By the way, the guidelines are not yet official. They are not yet launched, but they are in their final stages. On the 31st of January, we will be having a teleconference to put the final touches and ask the High Commissioner and the Director General of ICAO to write a foreword for them. So they will be implemented immediately after they become mandatory through civil aviation authorities.
What exactly are the procedures that the cabin crew members would take if they identify a victim?
I would say cabin crew and flight attendants mainly, they have developed strong observance skills. So when we fly, they look at us, they watch our movements. Sometimes they might approach a person. So they are so observant. If they see anything that is not right, they need to start thinking of the process. They start looking at the specific indicators. They monitor the behavioral attitudes of the person or the potential victim and the person accompanying that potential victim. So they need immediately to collect the information. And of course, the most important thing they need to stick to is to do no harm. They should not intervene to rescue a victim. They should not show other passengers that there is a situation there. They take the information. If they were in doubt, our advice in the guideline was you might approach a colleague of yours, share the information and see what do they think about the situation. And finally, when they collect all the information, it should be reported to the pilot, who is the law enforcement authority on the plane, who in turn should report it to the ground staff and the ground police. And the rule ends there. They are not a law enforcement agency on the ground, but rather the captain is on board the flight. So they leave it there. They report all the facts. They issue a report. They have their own internal procedures as cabin crew, where they have the protocols they follow in filling in different forms related to different acts that might take place on board a flight. So that's in general. The guidelines are more detailed in terms of the different steps, the issues they need to be looking at, specifically the specific indicators I've mentioned earlier.
And are these guidelines only for cabin crew members, or would it work also for the average person? Are there like signs that the average person could use to identify a potential victim of trafficking?
Yes, of course. Every individual, every person can contribute to identifying a victim of trafficking. The guidelines, they have general indicators and specific indicators. The specific indicators are indicators related to the cabin crew on board the flight. But the general indicators, they apply everywhere. So sometimes you go to a place, you see something that is not right. For example, we all know that forced marriage is a form of modern-day slavery and trafficking. So if you see a an 80 years old man going out with a 15 years old girl, then you suspect immediately that something is wrong and there is a case. And sometimes you have a responsibility as a good citizen to go and report to the relevant authorities. So, in other words, the guidelines can be used by other transport organizations because they are very specific to that industry. But they can, of course, be adapted and used in different scenarios and different constituencies.
Well, here in New York, the MTA, the New York subway system, has launched If You See Something, Say Something campaign that was later implemented nationwide by the Department of Homeland Security. How similar are these guidelines to that campaign?
Yes, I guess it falls under the Blue Campaign because the Blue Campaign is an initiative that a lot of actors were involved in that, including the Department of Transport and the Department of Homeland Security. And it had several elements related to rail stations, airlines, different transport organizations. So, of course, it relates to it and the training. And by the way, the guidelines were a joint venture. They were developed by members of the safety group of ICAO, which are representatives of airlines and civil aviation authorities. We sat around the table, and I was providing the elements related to international law and trafficking and human rights, and they were contributing with the elements related to their own industry, the things that they are experts at. So a lot of the elements in the Blue Campaign are almost the same elements in our guidelines, because trafficking is trafficking everywhere, and combating it can be addressed by different constituencies, but with the same purpose.
Ms. Hadadin, what are the latest statistics in that regard?
When it comes to trafficking?
Trafficking in person, yes.
It's a very difficult question, by the way. Nobody can answer because of the clandestine nature of the crime. We don't have any credible figures about it. It's not measurable. But I would say, for me, I rely on two sources. The first one are the global estimates issued by International Labour Organization. We've just issued them in September 2017. They were launched at the UN in the presence of the Secretary General, the High Commissioner, the Director General of IOM, and other important principals. OHCHR took part in developing some of the global estimates, especially when it comes to forced marriage. So this is a source that talks about an estimate. And the most recent estimate is around 41 million people are trafficked around the world. So we are talking about a huge number of individuals that are being subjected to all forms of exploitation. The other source I would rely on is the global report issued by the UNODC every 2 years. Of course, it doesn't provide a number, but provides trends and percentages. So when we look at the most recent one issued in 2016, 52% of victims around the world are women. 20% are girls, and boys are 18, I guess, if I recall from the top of my head. So if you combine the estimates of ILO with UNODC trends and percentages, then you come up with an understanding how big the problem is. That's why the Secretary General, during the appraisal of the Global Plan of Action, stressed that trafficking should be a priority across all pillars of the UN.
That was Yola Hadadin, an advisor on trafficking in persons with OHCHR. She spoke with UN Radio's Mustafa Al-Gamal.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
This is VOA and you're listening to Nightline Africa. Coming up next, music from our African collection for your listening pleasure and relaxation. That will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Yes, now it's time for our Sunday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great music from Africa.
Ne t'en fais pas ma chérie, je vais arrêter mes conneries. tu m'abandonnes. Trop d'excuses, rien que tu m'y donnes. On se prend la tête, pourquoi tu déconnes? Je peux plus supporter. Tout ça doit s'arrêter. C'est mon seul alibi.
Dans ma vie, je suis un homme. J'en ai rien à faire de ta monnaie. Non, j'ai pas d'un bad boy qui finira par tomber. Dans ma vie, je suis un homme. J'en ai rien à faire de ta monnaie. J'en fais le bon choix, j'ai pas regretté. J'suis déterminé.
Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie. Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie. Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie. J'vais arrêter mes conneries. Ne t'en fais pas, ma
pas tomber, tomber.
Ne t'en fais pas ma chérie. Ne t'en fais pas ma chérie. Ne t'en fais pas ma chérie. Je vais arrêter mes conneries. Ne t'en fais pas ma chérie. Ne t'en fais pas ma chérie. Ne t'en fais pas ma chérie. Je vais arrêter mes conneries.
El Mara Hassan.
Sister Nana, a combo could Jamaica Baba, a summer my bank manager, Kaya Farmer, or that is CJ Book could do a cassava, Sanana Waframa, Anyala Gada, Mamma make care with the moon to me in Anamananto, Ugola moon to Miss Lavacala Nasso, Mafi would be in Quaker, watching a match, and make care, Mayanina, Nama Mafio, Dread, Chawadoyan San. Ah, mono masa webu bulanga, motomo machacha, mananda ananta, Mamisha moves Samaya no by a homoka.
Trabanku ni simu jo. Shani kumu aminiye. Baba we na paga
huya
no tiyo. Trabanku ni simu jo. Shani kumu aminiye. Baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we,
baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we, baba we,
Nami wo.
Look at
Yes, that was our Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoyed the music. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. There is now an international consensus that President Joseph Kabila of the Democratic Republic of Congo and his close collaborators have violated the constitution of the country by prolonging the term of office of the president beyond 2016. It may be recalled that at the end of 2016, the Congolese opposition had protested the absence of elections. There were clashes and many died. The Catholic Church intervened and brokered an interim solution that provided for elections at the end of 2017 and the election of a new president. No such elections were held, and President Joseph Kabila is still the president of the DRC in violation of the Constitution. Recently, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Antonio Guterres, criticized the DRC government and called on the president to stand down. Recently also, there were clashes and many in the DRC died. And now the Catholic Church, which once acted as mediator, has now joined with the opposition parties and called on President Joseph Kabila to resign. The question now is, what should be done? President Kabila and his government have been using the domestic jurisdiction argument to say that no outside entity can tell the government of the DRC how and when to organize an election. This is the same argument that was used effectively by the government of Burundi when its president also violated its constitution and an agreement to go beyond the term limit in the constitution. However, as far as the DRC is concerned, there might be some difference. The United Nations, through its Security Council, has invested so much in the DRC by fielding for so many years a United Nations peacekeeping force to maintain domestic peace and tranquility. Therefore, the United Nations has a specific interest in maintaining stability in the DRC. The Secretary General, in one of his periodic reports to the Security Council about the peacekeeping force, or in a special report, can inform the Security Council of his concern about the refusal of President Kabila to stand down. But preferably, it would be better for the African Union to take the first bite on this issue. And to achieve this purpose, the Secretary General of the United Nations should be able to approach the chairperson of the African Union and to ask for collaboration to put necessary pressure on the government of President Kabila to vacate office. This could be done if the Security Council make it very clear that it would adopt specific sanctions on those individuals in the government of the DRC, including the president, that are obstacles to elections. Now, the government of the DRC is saying that elections will be made at the end of 2018. But this is unacceptable because this is the merry-go-round which the government has used in the past, and there are no guarantees that such elections will be held. This is the time for the international community to act and not to wait for more bloodshed in the DRC. The Secretary General has spoken, and it is time for both the Security Council and the African Union to act. I thank you.
That was a one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN and Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Producer Saida Hamdun, and our engineer tonight, Wojciech Zodiak, we thank you very much for joining us tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga. Have a great week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to Rwanda Erica Barks Ruggles visited the Kinazi sector in Huye this month to promote U.S. government-funded activities to combat malnutrition. During her visit in December, the ambassador observed growth monitoring promotion activities conducted at the village level, along with positive deviance hearth activities, which focus on identifying good behaviors practiced by mothers and caretakers of well-nourished children. The visit also allowed Ambassador Barks Ruggles to participate in a farmer field school demonstration of kitchen gardens. The ambassador distributed garden and kitchen tools to community members and helped serve a nutritious lunch to participating children. The U.S. Embassy in Kigali awarded a $250,000 grant to Francis Xavier Bagnud, Rwanda, in September to improve nutritional behaviors, as well as water sanitation and hygiene, and to combat malnutrition in all 14 sectors of Huye. The project is expected to assist 53,000 children under the age of 5 and 10,000 pregnant and lactating women. It will also promote male engagement in the nutrition of their children. The project started in Gishamvu sector in October and will be completed in 2019. This program is part of the U.S. government-wide approach to accelerate progress in nutrition. Through USAID-funded programs such as Community Health and Improved Nutrition and Feed the Future, the U.S. government is helping strengthen and expand community-based nutrition programs to prevent undernutrition in young children and in pregnant and lactating women, as well as to promote agricultural productivity across Rwanda. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Rwanda, to help meet the critical nutritional needs of the Rwandan people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.